AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. I'm Jim Cornell, editor of the WalkingPost.com website, and that is the news site dedicated to walking, with all the latest on new trails, walking festivals, books, gear, clothing, and more. This podcast is airing on Friday, March the 7th, in case you're listening to it in the summer and wondering why 14 degrees sounds so amazing. I hope you were able to take a walk this week. I did manage to get a nice walk in last Sunday when it was almost sunny, but very cold. We went up to Glasgow to do a walk along the banks of the River Clyde, and it was freezing. I almost lost my baseball cap in the wind, which would have served me right for not wearing a warm beanie, or whatever they're called these days. The river and the parks were packed with people, not because of the weather, but because there was a Pokemon Go event on. So there were groups of about 100 people heading from one Pokestop to the next. At least they were getting some good exercise. I've also been reading a lot of hiking books lately and just finished one called Tales from the Big Trails by Martin Howe, which is his account of walking all 19 national trails in England, Scotland and Wales. That number may have changed since he wrote the book, but he did about 3,000 miles in total, and I really enjoyed it for the most part. I certainly can't say the same about one that I'm reading now. Maybe next week when I'm finished it, I'll let you know why I think it's not very good. If you have recommendations for books on walking, please do let me know. My 13-year-old son and I are going to be tackling the Fife Coastal Path next month and filming it, so I'll be starting that on Monday. At least the week that we're going in April, you can pretty much guarantee it will rain. I did part of the Camino del Norte along the Spanish coast last year and got pretty sick with gastroenteritis, and I have never seen so many people on a trail just outside of Bilbao. I thought maybe Paul McCartney was doing an open-air concert or something. Hopefully you tuned into the podcast last week when we talked about the Malvern Walking Festival and Capricorn Mohair Socks. If not, you can catch up on the podcast player on walkingpost.com, or you can type Walking Post into your favourite podcast platform like Spotify and subscribe there. So, who's on the show this week? Well, good question. This week we're talking about the Chepstow Walking Festival with Helen from the Chepstow Walkers Are Welcome group, one of the organisers of the festival. And the other interview is with Sadia Barber, CEO of Experience Pakistan, which does bespoke holidays in, you guessed it, Pakistan. And because you can create your own holiday, it can include walking. Before we get to the interviews, just to keep you in suspense, I should tell you what the news articles we had on WalkingPost.com were this week. We had an article on the launch of the new Bondi 9 shoes. Maidstone's Heart of Kent Walking Festival is ready to go at the end of this month, and I didn't think I'd ever mention her in a podcast, but tennis player Venus Williams has become an ambassador for and invested in the WeWard app. It's an app where you get rewards for walking, basically. Rab has announced its backpack range for spring and summer, and there's some nice-looking packs there as well. The sock company Features is launching t-shirts, and we had an interesting article on the cheapest places to go in Turkey and what walks you can do near those places. I really like Turkey, not that I've seen a great deal of it, When I flew to the Middle East, the flight went over Turkey, and you don't realise just how many mountains there are and how mountainous it is. I was in Istanbul at an event for a week once and amazed at how long it took to get out of the city to go walking. City just seems to go on forever before you get to countryside. Finally, we had an article on five of the top places to go in Asia to go walking and see the beautiful cherry blossoms. And no, they're not all in Japan. I have a cherry tree currently in flower in my garden that easily has eight flowers in it, but no tourists have yet passed through to get some pictures. I've never been to the Japanese Blossom Festival. When I was last in Japan, it was in September, so not exactly good timing for the blossom. And that was pre-Pokemon days too. Anyway, you can read all of these articles and more at walkingpost.com. Right, it's time for this week's interviews. There are lots of walking festivals, and some of them even start very soon. And the ones that don't, some of those are announcing their schedule of walks. One of those festivals is the Chepstow Walking Festival, which is put on by the Chepstow Walkers Are Welcome group. And Helen, one of those members responsible for the festival, can tell us about not only the festival, but first, she can tell us more about the Chepstow Walkers Are Welcome group.
Right, good morning, Jim. Thanks for inviting me to share your podcast with you. I'm a founding member of Chepstow Walkers Are Welcome, and we're a volunteer-led community not-for-profit group. We're made up of local people, and we've got local accommodation providers, walkers, representatives from local organisations such as Keep Chepstow Tidy, a couple of ramblers, Long Distance Walking Association, U3A and RSPB. We all live in the area and we have a passion for walking in the place that we live, basically. Walkers Are Welcome is a nationwide scheme whose aim is to provide the best possible walking experience for visitors and the local community, and supported by a number of local businesses, because it is also to support the local economy. We had to jump through a number of hoops to get accreditation, but enthusiasm and determination got us there in the end, and we gained our accreditation in April 2012, which coincided with the official opening of the Wales Coast Path, which starts and ends at Chepstow. Why Chepstow? Well, Chepstow's got four major long-distance national trails that either start or end here, which offers a great choice for walkers. There's the Wales Coast Path from Chepstow to the outskirts of Chester. That's a 170-mile walk on the coast. Offers Dyke Path, which starts at Sedbury Cliffs on the outskirts of Chepstow and finishes at Prestatyn. That's another 177 miles. And if you combine the Wales Coast Path and the Offers Dyke Path, it was at one time it was the only place in the world that you could walk almost virtually around a country. We've also have the Wye Valley Walk, which is 136 miles. It starts in the mountains of Mid Wales to Chepstow Castle. And last but not least is Gloucestershire Way, which starts at the old Wye Bridge at Chepstow and finishes at Tewkesbury via the Forest of Dean and the Cotswolds, about 100 miles, and which I've done most of those anyway. So they're lovely, lovely walks.
Plenty to keep you going with all those long distance walks converging on Chepstow.
I've yet to do the Wales Coast Path. That's a lot. Some of our members have done it. They just finished and it took a number of years. We've also got a very enthusiastic long distance walker who, gosh, he walks miles and miles and miles. It would be nothing to him. But to me, a walk of about 8 miles is enough, really. I can do 10 at a stretch, but I like to stop and look at the views and get my sandwiches out and have a cup of coffee and stuff like that, really.
Could you tell me about the walking festival's history, when it started and what it looked like when it started?
Well, in 2014, which is about 2 years after we'd become accredited, we found our feet. We decided to dip our toe into organising our first walking festival. We'd organised several walks, such as a family blackberry walk and a few others, but not on a full-scale festival. So it was a bit daunting at first, to say the least. Anyway, we decided and we gritted our teeth and got on with it. And it comprised of 15 walks over a long weekend in April, starting on Saturday. the walks were led by some members of the steering group who were experienced walk leaders, and others who were specialists in their field, such as wildlife and history, and willing to give up their free time. We had a grand opening by the mayor in the centre of town, and a performance by our local scene club choir, who really got into the spirit of the event by singing a couple of numbers. You could probably guess what they are, actually. It was These Boots Are Made for Walking, and I Will Walk 500 Miles. It was such great fun, and there were kids dancing around and everything, and it gave a real party atmosphere. In fact, somebody introduced himself. He dressed up as a hiker in stilts and was wandering around the town giving out our leaflets. It was fantastic. It was so successful, the festival, that over the years we've expanded it to last for 7 days. But we always start on the first Tuesday after Easter Bank Holiday Monday, celebrating that we are a Walkers of Welcome town. And I think a measure of its success is that local organisations and businesses now get in touch and ask how they can become involved. We never have a shortage of experienced walk leaders who either live or work here. They readily give up their time devising and checking a route, whether it to be showcase a viewpoint, a heritage site, or, I don't know, introduce a visit to the amazing producers in this area. They all go out in all weathers and make sure there are no problems on the route and either deal with it themselves or work in partnership with Monmouthshire Rights of Way team. I think what is best about the festival is the way it brings people from so many groups and backgrounds together through a shared experience. I could tell you about some highlights over the years. We had a flash dance after the singing club was so successful the first year. They did a flash dance in the centre of Chepstow, where about 60 of them dressed up in bobble hats, rucksacks and walking boots and performed a flash dance, much to the amazement and delight of the local shoppers. Several long lost friends who hadn't seen each other meeting up after years of losing touch. Chepstow Racecourse allowed us to walk around the perimeter of the racetrack. It's about 1 to 2 miles on a hard surface, and that meant it was accessible to most. It was free, and the first year we did it there were about 30 walkers, and after a couple of years there were several hundred turned up, to our great surprise and delight. And it was a fantastic opportunity to have a really unique view of the racecourse, and for parents to walk with their children either alongside or in a buggy in a safe area, as well as people who are not so active as they were. So that was a few highlights that we've had. We limit our walks to 20 participants, and on the rare occasions 25, plus there's two walk leaders, and we found that's the most manageable number and more enjoyable. I mean, if you're in a group and you have to wait to get over a stile, if you have a huge number of people, it's just everybody gets fed up waiting around, or they get cold. So we find 20 is the best number for us, and we started off with 15 walks, as I said. And now this year we've got 38. I have stats if you want some.
Yeah, definitely.
We've got one of our committee members, steering group members, Steve, is brilliant at preparing stuff like this. At the end of the festival, we get pie charts and stats and everything. But it is very useful. You know, it helps us really to decide where we're going to put the walks and how to advertise. So I have some stats from last year. 36 walks. 537 tickets sold. That added up to 230 miles altogether in walks. And with all the people walking, it came to 3,105 miles walked. And the weather was just appalling. COVID was still lurking as well. So we had a 17.5% cancellation rate. But during the festival, the weather did improve, in so much it rained before the walks and after, but never during, which was a relief. And on the last day, we did have a little glimmer of sunshine, which was well received. Walk leaders, I know myself, going out to face these big muddy paths and trying to look for alternative routes, so that if we did have a lot of rain on the day, it wouldn't, you know, make it impassable. But it all worked out in the end. And I think walkers are a hardy lot. And actually, when we all stood there eating our sandwiches in the pouring rain, and one woman said to me, she said, "I can't believe that I've paid to do this." It's a sort of camaraderie, really, that develops between the group, which is one of the things I like about it, really.
You must have learned a lot over the years as well, though.
Oh, yeah, learned a lot. Yeah, learned what to avoid as well. you know, we've had people turn up. The walk leader has the last say on who can join in on the walk, because we explain on the website, you know, to wear the comfortable shoes or suitable shoes and clothing, bring a drink, the normal things that you'd expect if you're going out for a walk in the countryside. And some people have turned up in flip-flops when they're going to go on a 5-mile walk. We put it out there as best we can that you have to wear the best clothing, be prepared, bring a waterproof coat. And things change, as you know, you're walking yourself. Things really change, don't they? You go up hills and it could be beautifully and sunny at the bottom. And by the time you've got to the top, it's cold and misty or wet. So we do actually try and put that across to people.
Do you get people from far afield, or is it mostly local?
Well, actually, amazed. When people book a ticket, we always ask for a postcode, so we have an idea of where they've come from. Or the walk leader might ask by a show of hands at the start of the walk if they're local. It's always a good point of conversation and gets people talking to each other anyway. About 35% are local, or from within the county of Monmouthshire, and the remainder are from elsewhere. We've had a number of loyal regulars that come down from London and the north and the southwest. And we've also had an international following, people coming from the USA, Argentina, all sorts of places. And we've already had inquiries this year from Canada.
So what do you have in store for the 2025 version?
Oh, it's a great program. I'm bound to say that, but it is a really good program this year. We've got 38, the most yet. The walks always range from a gentle stroll to a more challenging hike, with most walks ranging from 2 to 13 miles each day. We've got everything from a wildlife walk, including a bat walk along the River Wye, with bat detectors and an expert answering any questions. Ringing of the church bells at St Nicholas Church in Trellick after 5.5-mile walk. That's brilliant because they take you up into the bell tower and they give you a demonstration. It is so interesting, and then you can all have a pull on the bell at the end. And then we always try and coincide any walk in Trellick with their local teas, which are beautiful. They have lovely pieces of cake all made by the local ladies. We've got visits to local producers, which are not always open to the public. And some of them let us have samples of ice cream or cheese. We've got a walk solely Welsh speaking. They go on the walk. The walk is conducted in Welsh, and we have one of those every year. There's a pilgrim walk visiting 4 different churches during a 12-mile walk over some absolutely stunning countryside. I think when people don't realise how beautiful, I know I may sound biased, but Monmouthshire is a beautiful country. It's got a diverse landscape from the wetlands down in the south to the edge of the Black Mountains and the Beacons National Park to the Wye Valley and the Usk Valley. So there's always something to look at, distant views. It is really stunning, and we try and highlight this during the festival so that if people are coming through Monmouthshire, they usually zoom along the M4 to the west coast and miss us altogether. So it's a quiet place to walk. But that's why people come back every year, really, to just enjoy it. We've got a couple of church tours thrown in, and new this year, and this is quite exciting. We've got a visit and a talk to a filmmaker and writer, Adam Alexander, and he's also known as the Seed Detective. He's been on a quest to seek out unusual, rare, and above all, delicious vegetables that we could all grow at home. And we visit his home vegetable plot, which is not open to the public halfway through. And we'll learn about some of his accidental seed heroes and growers who are championing traditional varieties and breeding delicious new ones to withstand the shocks of changing climate. So we do have a diverse program, which we, you know, some will be specialist interest and some will just literally be a lovely, uninterrupted walk in the countryside and just to enjoy it. I think any walking festival, certainly Chepstow Walking Festival, it provides lots of great opportunities to meet other people who also love walking and make new friends. I know during my time on Chepstow Walkers of Welcome, I've made some fantastic friends, and you can learn about the rich heritage of the place, which is on our doorstep. it's just a beautiful thing to do. I think festival bagging is now becoming very popular. I myself, I'll go on with a friend, we go up to Evesham Walking Festival or over to Glamorgan or Gloucestershire, all over the place really, to go and join a walk, because you, for a very, you know, a small sum, we charge £5 for each of our walks. It's not very much for a couple of hours walk from a person who's passionate about what they do and what they see and where they live, and it sort of spills over into the group. I think of it like a good recipe. If you get a good recipe, you want to share it with everybody, and that's like a good walk in the countryside, really.
Are they all child and dog friendly, or are there some that aren't?
Well, dogs. Well, we don't have dogs on every walk because sometimes the styles are too difficult, or there may be lots of livestock, and some people who are in a group don't like what, you know, they are curious animals, and we've always got to think of the health and safety. But we always ensure there is one or two walks a day that are dog friendly. And they've been devised with dogs in mind. So they've got no encounters with livestock. There's no styles. And they're in woods where, if they're well controlled, they can be, have the chance to be off lead and even have a splash about in a stream. Child friendly, I suppose it would be dependent, as with adults, on the fitness of the child. But we do have a walk this year, which is specific to 6 to 11 year olds. Last year, we introduced Jan Little, and she's an experienced professional storyteller from Strolls and Stories, who became the Good Witch of Trellick. She was so well received, and to encourage more children to get outdoors, she agreed to return this year as Mrs. Bilbo Baggins. Her theme is, Mrs. Baggins is greatly irritated by her son's fame as he deserted her to go on an adventure. Eager to tell her side of the story, show off her storytelling skills, and reveal the secrets of the tree spirits and elves in Great Barnet's Wood, which is a beautiful wood just on the outskirts of Chepstow. And hopefully, and if the weather is kind to us this year, it'd be full of bluebells. She's going to be looking at trees and getting them to see faces within the bark. We try and encourage young people to come on walks, and it is difficult, but that's a start, really. If you can get them out early. I mean, I know with my own son, at 12, 13, he never wanted to come and walk with me. He, you know, he sort of trailed behind, but the seeds were sown, and now he often goes on a walk, and he joined the walking festival last year. In his 20s, he started, and it's lovely. So you never know what you're inspiring them to do, really.
You've kind of already gone over some of the details, but I wonder if you could go over the dates for the festival and how people book and accommodation, those kind of things.
Sure. Right, the festival this year is running from Tuesday the 22nd of April until Sunday the 27th of April, and the cost of an adult single ticket is £5. It's been £5 since we started, and under 16s are free, but they must be accompanied by an adult. Accommodation wise, we've got Forest of Dean on the doorstep, as well as the Wye Valley, so there's lots of accommodation. In fact, there's a backpackers hostel called the Green Man, which is located in the centre of Chepstow. I know some of the walkers that attend the festival use that. There's a youth hostel as well up in St Breville's, which is only 8 miles away, and there's all sorts of accommodation, from glamping, camping, Airbnbs and small hotels, or there's something more exclusive end, which is St Pierre, which is just outside Chepstow. So there's always plenty of accommodation around. And if they want to book, then, which is essential, as we said, the places are limited, you go to the website, which is walksinchepstow.co.uk.
Is it easy to get around? You mentioning the accommodation. How easy is it to get from, if you were staying just outside of Chepstow, to get to the starts of the walks?
We have public transport on the description of the walk, so which bus that you can get. There's always a car park at the beginning, because that's one of the main things. You've got a group of people, at least 10 cars are going to turn up. If you have problems getting to the start, we always say on the booking information, please contact this number, and we'll try and arrange car share or something like that, or the walk leader. We've always got a couple of people from the committee are available and run people round, picking them up and taking them to the start. And then you find that by the end of the week, people are sharing lifts anyway because they've got to know each other.
I suppose it's not just the walks, though, because some of them are themed. So you're probably also looking for themes to do each year ones.
Yeah, that's true. As I said, it's just amazing now. Through social media, people will get in contact with us and say, I see the festival and you called at that farm or you called there. Would you like to come and visit us? Because it does give them some publicity, which is helpful to them. And that's what we want to do. We want to encourage people to use the local pubs, accommodation, the cafes and the restaurants and everything. That's what we actually want people to do and encourage visitors to come here.
Good for the whole community, I guess.
Yes, it is. That's the most important thing about Walkers Are Welcome. It separates us from being a rambling group where you're a member of a club. As a Walkers Are Welcome town, you embrace all the groups and you encourage everybody, locals and visitors alike, to use the local facilities, because without that, the towns are dying. A lot of places now, particularly pubs in rural areas, rely on walking groups. We do a walk for health every Monday, and there's some of us, we're going for a nice healthy bacon sandwich after the walk, and we'd probably spend about 80-90 quid, but that's giving that small cafe business for that day on a generally quiet day on Monday.
Just like last week with the Malvern Walking Festival, I'd love to get down to Chepstow for some of those walks. It sounds really beautiful. Another area that I'm ashamed to say I've not really explored much. Now we're talking about a country that some might not think of as a destination for walking holidays, and that's Pakistan. Someone who wants to change all that is Sadia Barber, who started up her company Experience Pakistan to promote holidays there. I met her at the Destinations Travel Show in London last month, although it was so busy and noisy, if I'd have done the interview there, you wouldn't hear a word. So we left it until afterwards and things had calmed down a bit.
So I guess to get things started, then, I wonder if you could just maybe tell me a bit about the company, what you do and why you started the company and that kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. So Experience Pakistan, I always say, is for me a passion project. It's a patriotic project. It was never set up as a commercial entity. And I set it up back in 2018. So I'm a mum of three boys. And at the time is basically when you had a lot on the press about young boys joining ISIS. And there was a whole kind of, some of them were educated boys. There were also reports coming out where a lot of young men or Pakistani boys associated themselves as being British Muslims, but wanted to disassociate themselves with being Pakistani. And for me, I thought, okay, there's a bit of an identity crisis here. And part of the reason is because the only time these children, the only time Pakistan is ever mentioned in the press is for negative stuff. You know, it's whether it's the Rotherham gangs or whether it's the odd incident which happens in Pakistan, which happens, if I'm honest, terrorist attacks, unfortunately, is something we live with on a global level. That's not just in Pakistan, that happens everywhere. But yet, none of the good stuff was ever spoken about or never brought to people's attention. Personally, although I spent most of my life in the UK, I was lucky enough that when I was 16, my father was transferred back to Pakistan and we moved back and I lived there for 3 years from the age of 16 to 19. So I attended college, and although we were always kind of going to Pakistan every year anyway for either an uncle's wedding or something. So I was never, even living here, disconnected with the country, and I had a real love for the country. But I think living there really embedded my desire and passion for Pakistan, and having more empathy in terms of when some things don't go right, having lived there, understanding that. So I think for me, when I graduated my MBA, I always said to my fellow students in Brussels that say, look, I'm privileged because I've got fantastic parents who were very supportive of me getting educated. But also, I had the financial means to do that. But I know there are many girls in Pakistan who probably deserve to be here more than me because they're far more intelligent than me, but they just don't maybe have the financial resources or the support. So I think I said at some point I would like to be able to do something where I can give back to the community of Pakistan and really help them. And then, life takes a thing where after I finished, I got a job at Unilever and Coke and did my about 15 years of corporate life. And then I think it was like kind of, as I said, in 2016, I left work and for various personal reasons as a woman, you know, childcare, looking for, after my mother-in-law for 2 years. In 2018, then when my mother-in-law sadly passed away, my husband was like, well, you're a bit free now. What do you want to do? And it was a case of, well, I can either go back to the corporate world or I can do what I really want to do and set up my own company, but do something where I can give back and help people. And that was where the birth of Experience Pakistan came about, because I thought, well, actually, the best thing I could do sitting overseas is I can develop holidays and tours and show people Pakistan through my eyes rather than through the lens of the BBC or Sky News. But also in doing so, I can actually work with local cafes, local restaurants, you know, local guides and tours, and help empower them rather than just give money, you know, as charity, actually provide employment for them. And that's why Experience Pakistan almost killed those two birds with one stone, where I could actually look at changing perceptions, changing narratives of Pakistan, but also help the locals in a way that would give them a sense of pride and also create employment opportunities. So that's a very long answer, I know, to that question of how Experience Pakistan came about.
Obviously, you're based in the UK, but is it mostly UK people that would use your services, or is it people from other nationalities as well?
Although based in the UK, but I'm an online company, so therefore actually I get clients from all over the world. So I get a lot of Australians, quite a few Europeans and some Americans. So actually, you know, proportionally, actually, it's interesting. Most of my clients today have been Australians, but, you know, for the last 2 years, I've started to do a lot more shows in the UK. So, you know, being attending the Luxury Travel Show and Destinations London. And I think that has been a bit of a game changer for me, where because of the way the British people, and certainly, you know, kind of the older British people, tend to book their holidays or shop for their holidays, where they tend to use these shows as their annual travel agency, I am now starting to see a lot more, you know, English people book myself.
Putting your promotion hat on, I guess, what are the advantages and attractions for people to visit Pakistan?
So I think the number one attraction, and this is something that I'm not saying, but all of my clients have said to me when they've come back, is that Pakistan is so off the beaten track that quite often when you go, you will probably be the only foreigner there. Because of that, that's what my clients have loved. They said, you know, we're not going where we're seeing lots of other Brits or seeing lots of other similar faces. You know, we're often the only white face, and they love that. And the other things, if you think about, for most countries, international tourism is about 10% of their GDP. For Pakistan, it's only 2%. And of the 2%, when I say proper tourism, where, you know, it's people like yourself going, it only is about 0.5%. So because of that, it's not commercialized at all. So the culture and a lot of what you see is still very authentic, whereas with probably a lot of other destinations, they've probably lost their authenticity and they've become a lot more commercialized. So I always say to everyone, you know, now's a good time to go to Pakistan, because in another 8 or 9 years, I suspect what's quite raw and authentic now will be a bit more commercialized and you'll have lost that charm. And, you know, certainly if we think about just last month in January, we had BBC Travel, CNN Travel, Financial Times and New York Times Travel all put Pakistan as one of the top destinations to visit 2025. So it's getting a lot of good travel press coverage. So, you know, that will probably trickle down. So probably you'll start seeing the real impact in another 4 years, 5 years. So I'm saying to, you know, all your audience, now next year is probably a really good time to go, where it's still very raw. Because the question I get from people, you know, people don't know much about Pakistan. You know, why would you go? What is there to see? I always say, you know, Pakistan, you can split in a north and south divide. So the north of Pakistan is very much, and probably a lot of your audience who are trekking or like walking, is where you've got the natural landscape, the beauty, where you can do lots of kind of walks around the lakes or see, you know, I think Pakistan is home to 9 of the tallest mountain peaks in the world. But if that's not your thing and it's a lot more about culture, history, archaeology, then I always say, well, that's the south of Pakistan, you know, so from Islamabad going down to Karachi. So there's something for everyone. You know, if it's natural beauty, like you would go up north. If it's more history, culture, people watching, photography, then that's probably more down south. And of course, if it's food, then you can go anywhere in Pakistan because we're known for our food.
Definitely. What else can people expect when they go there? I'm thinking, you know, climate and the people.
The people, I think, are the biggest assets of Pakistan in terms of the hospitality and the warmth. I think if anyone of your listeners, you know, have Pakistani friends, you'll know that one of the things that we are known for, just from a cultural perspective, you know, even the Pakistani people living here in the UK, is the hospitality. And that's something that a lot of my customers have said they've loved, that wherever they've gone, they feel like they're at home because of the warmth with which the people greet them. So that's definitely something that is a big asset. I think the other thing is the food, you know, the variety of food. Now, I do get asked the question that if we're a vegetarian or vegan, is there anything on offer? Pakistan, I do what generally is a meat-eating country. You know, a lot of our diet revolves around meat. However, that said, absolutely, if you're vegetarian or vegan, you know, there are dishes like lentils, like okra, like spinach that's served. What you won't probably get is a menu where there's a plethora, you know, specifically catering for a vegetarian or vegan, but there will always be something on the menu for a vegetarian or vegan to eat. In terms of climate, what people don't realise, I think people often associate Pakistan with being a hot country, and that's probably not true. So I think if you go from Punjab down towards Karachi, Karachi probably is the only part or the Sindh province which is hot all year round. And in winters, it's not as hot, but generally it's hot all year round. So when I say not as hot, you're probably talking about mid to high 20s in the winter autumn months, and then probably, you know, mid to high 40s in the summer months. But where I come from, Peshawar, up in the northwest of Pakistan, we get all four seasons. So our winters, you know, are cold. You do have to wear a jacket and a shawl and a socks. We have autumn, and then, you know, we have lovely spring, which is typically like the UK. Spring is around between March and end of April, where it's the best weather and you can walk around where it's not too hot and it's not cold. So, you know, you can wear nice cotton clothing and very comfortable. And then kind of from middle of May onwards is where you start seeing, you know, the temperatures go up, and we get, you know, summers can be very hot. In terms of the northern Pakistan, so Hunza, Gilgit, which is the areas that all the press are talking about, they have bitterly cold winters. We don't normally do tours up northern Pakistan between the months of kind of October 15th to about the end of April. And part of the reason is because the roads aren't as accessible, because, you know, they get heavy snowfalls, temperatures drop to about minus 15. You know, remember Pakistan, the concept of central heating doesn't really exist. That's one of the reasons why we wouldn't do any tours up north, because if they were to stay in hotels, you know, they're just not geared up for that climate, and it wouldn't be pleasant for our customers. But in the summers, you know, temperatures can go up to mid 30s. So normally, you know, as I said, those tours for up north, we tend to do from May to about middle of October.
Could you tell me a bit more about the tours themselves, and sort of what people would expect if they're booking? And are they on their own? Are they with people? How does that all work?
Sure. So we do too. We do what are called group tours. So they have like a relatively set itinerary of what's done. It's about 20% of what we do. But 80% of what we do is tailor-made bespoke tours. The shortest tour we've ever done is about 8 days. And the longest tour is actually one we're doing this year in August for 23 days, which is like all of northern Pakistan. When you book with us, what we pride ourselves is it kind of not just our customer service is, but to ensure that you get the best local experience. So you always have your own private transportation. You have your own English speaking guide and you have a driver. The English speaking guide is a local and the drivers are local as well. Again, part of the point of that is to make sure that we're employing locals and we're creating employment opportunities for them. I also find it's the best way to give you the most authentic experience, you know, because they've got such good local knowledge, not just of obviously the key tourist attractions, which you'll read about the magazines of what you should do, but also about, you know, the local cafes or a local trek or a local walk, which only the locals would know about. And often, because you've got the same guide and same driver throughout the whole trip, they develop a really good understanding with my clients. They get to really know by day two what my clients are interested in and what they're not. And often by day two, they'll say to my clients, you know, if you've seen enough moths or forts, we know something else that actually, you know, so some one customer, for example, was really interested in local handicraft. So the guide knew of a local woman who does great handicraft and local. So he said, look, would you rather go? We can take you to her house and you can have a look. I think 100% of the time my clients listen to what my guides are saying and have taken up, and they've thoroughly enjoyed it. I think 2 years ago, there was a client who took a couple from Australia, and it was a driver's niece's pre-wedding event. And as you do in Pakistan, he said, look, we've got this event. It was a henna night. You know, would you like to come along? And they did. And I always create a WhatsApp group with all my clients 3 weeks before they're leaving so that they don't feel that I've taken their money and disappeared off the radar. It's to reassure them. A, we within the group, we have the local driver, the guide, so they can say their hellos. in the UK or Australia, wherever they are, before they actually arrive in Pakistan. But it's also to just reassure my clients that I'm with them virtually so that I can help them. So this client was like, she was sharing me pictures. She goes, "Oh, look, Sadie, we're having a great time." And she showed me her hands ordained with henna, which was lovely. So from that perspective, it's really good that I always say my clients get a proper authentic holiday. In terms of the actual fixed tours, you know, the most popular tour we have is what I call our cultural heritage tour. That starts in Islamabad and ends in Karachi, and that's about 14 to 16 days and includes cities like Islamabad, Peshawar, Lahore, Multan. And within that, there are key attractions you see like the Mohenjo-Daro, Uch Sharif, which is down Sindh. You've got the Faisal Mosque. You've got the Wagha border. So the Wagha border, I best describe, if you think about the change of the guards at Buckingham Palace, it's the Pakistan's equivalent. So it's where you've got the border between Pakistan and India. And it happens every day at 4:30 throughout the year. And it's this huge dramatic thing where you've got soldiers from either side going to meet centre point, raising the flag and lowering the flag. But it's done so dramatically. And what I love about it is the good spirit, both on the Indian side and the Pakistan side, where everyone's there just to have a good time. And it is a really unique experience to enjoy. So, of course, that's included in that tour. The other popular tour I have is kind of up north, which entails Hunza and Skardu. And in Hunza, you know, the key things that it's famous for is Atabad Lake, which was actually a lake made on the back of the disaster that happened, I think, back in 2018, where there was a landslide. And actually, it used to be a pathway between two villages, two communities where they would access and trade by road. But when the landslide happened, one of the mountains basically blocked the route. And in doing so, you've got this natural, beautiful lake called Atabad Lake, which is known because of its colours. So I think if you go before midday, it's a gorgeous, like, blue colour. But then if you were to go there after 12 or 1 o'clock, the colour changes to a more turquoise emerald green. But again, that kind of every year goes down by about 10 centimetres. So it's one of those things that see it while you can, because it's not going to be there forever. The other famous place, which I absolutely love, is Pasu Cones. You know, Pasu Cones, if you're an amateur photographer like me, you'll love it. I mean, when I went there in 2019, I don't think there were enough. I couldn't take enough pictures, because from every angle you see, you just see a different perspective. If I think specifically, Jim, about your audience, because I know they tend to be walkers, depending on how strenuous and how much you want, some of the famous walks or trekking tours that Pakistan's known for are things like the Snow Lake Trek. It's quite a hard walk, and I know because I saw a YouTube video recently on that, and I just got tired looking at the video because it was like, wow, that is strenuous. But it's a video that I would highly recommend. The more popular ones are the K2 Circular Trek. Then you've got the Rakaposhi Base Camp, which is popular. And those treks tend to range from 18 to 22 days and entail predominantly camping. So you've got a bit of snow and hotel at the start, but they are very much your hardcore trekking gear. And again, you would have a guide and you would have the whole team that would be carrying your equipment as you go. If you're more like me, where I don't mind walking, I like walking, but I probably then want to stay in a hotel at the end of the evening and I'm not going to be spending 20 days like camping, is there are a lot of short walks. Like when I say short walks, so 3 or 4 hour walks that we design into people's itineraries. So, you know, this is for clients who want to go up north, want to do a bit of hiking, walking, but they want to do it at a leisurely pace. So then those walks are famous, like Borik Lake. So Borik Lake is a beautiful lake and there's a 3 hour trek that you can do around it. Hingal National Park is famous for, if you like your wildlife, in the months of April, May, you can see the ibex there. And again, within that, you know, we have designed for our clients, in fact, got a client going in May, and they've got a day where they're spending in Hingal National Park. So they're doing a 3 or 4 hour walk. Hopefully we'll see some ibex there, and then we've arranged a picnic for them, you know, while they're there to do. And then the other one is Hopper Valley. So Hopper Valley is famous because, whereas traditionally you see glaciers on top, it's what it's famous for is actually the glaciers, the way they come, and it's a black lake, but they're actually built underneath the river. So the angle and the view with which you see it is very different. And there again, you've got a trek you can do ranging from 3 hours to 5 hours, depending on your stamina and how strenuous you want it to be.
Are you able to cater for walkers that either are not very experienced or don't want to break every muscle in their body and right the way through to the strenuous hikes?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I mentioned to you that we can arrange for short 3-hour walks, yeah, absolutely. And I said that I would classify me and my family at that bottom of the thing where we don't mind walking, but we're not, you know, we don't want to spend extraneous. We want to just a nice, you know, pass. So yeah, absolutely. And that's where I think having local guides and local teams really help, because they've got over 30, 40 years experience. So they're very familiar with the terrain and know where the gradients are significantly great, which would, as I said, which is where we would classify extraneous, to where there's probably flat and it's just a nice, enjoyable walk. So yeah, no, absolutely. We cater for the whole spectrum.
All right. And families as well, like younger children?
Yes, I spoke to a lovely, I mean, they didn't book with us, but they went to Pakistan. I met them at Destinations London, and they did the Rakaposhi base camp. So it was a lovely couple. They're both teachers, and they've got three like teenage children. So I think their children's ages range from 10 to 14. So they just did the Rakaposhi base camp this summer, and I saw them in January. You know, they came to Destinations again. I had really good catch up with them, and they were like telling me they absolutely loved it. They obviously come across as a family that tend to do hikes and walks, so they're very familiar with it, because Rakaposhi base camp, I would say, is probably on your medium to strenuous level. Now, with a lot of the base camp and the treks, there is the option where, because they start off as medium, and then as you can imagine, as you're going to the greater, that's where they become more strenuous. So with some customers in the past, what they've done is some of them have said, right, okay, we'll just stay here and enjoy the views and enjoy the day here, whilst the rest of the group have gone on to do that. So that is a way around you can do that. So I think, again, I always say Pakistan is a great destination where if you've got teenagers, I think if there's anything younger where there's nappies and pushchairs and things like that involved, I don't think Pakistan's a destination. But I think because whether it's down south you're doing, or whether you're up north, it requires you being on the move or walking. So I think for that reason, I would never recommend it for anyone younger where you need to have stops for loo breaks and you need a pushchair and stuff like that. It's just not a destination, yeah, designed for that kind of audience.
And I guess you've had the opportunity through the destinations and through other means to explain about Pakistan, but what are the common misconceptions as a tourist destination, and how are you addressing those?
So the number one misconception is, or the question I always get is, I'd love to go, but is Pakistan safe? I've heard it's really dangerous. And for me, what's been fantastic is, whereas in 2018, people had to trust me because I had to, you know, reassure people and say, look, you know, I've lived there, my whole family lives there. You know, if there was any danger, I wouldn't do it. But since then, we've got a lot of YouTube bloggers who are going to Pakistan, and they're made up of a mix of young men, but also women, you know, and actually families going. And they've been creating great content on Pakistan and uploading it. So now actually what I tend to do, I said, look, I won't say anything, because anything I say you won't believe, because you'll think I'm trying to sell a holiday to Pakistan to you, is I actually show them video links of people, foreigners, Americans, Australians, who have been to Pakistan, and give them their objective. And I haven't come across any video to date on YouTube where any blogger has said, I didn't feel safe. Most of them have been, in fact, all the ones I've seen have been so positive and complimentary about Pakistan and the hospitality and warmth that the people have shown. And, you know, they've said exactly what I say. Look, don't believe the media, because the media is not showing you the true reflection of what Pakistan is really like. I've been fortunate enough where, because I tend to do presentations at Luxury Travel Fair, is clients who have been with me have created videos answering that question and shared those with me. And I tend to put those in my presentation deck. And again, say, look, these are objective people who have been to Pakistan and their view on it.
I know you put out really good newsletters frequently. Is that a good way of communicating not only the things that you do, but also good information about Pakistan?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because obviously, look, we live in an era where we're all fed up. I'm sure we're on many mailing lists and we're inundated and we're like thinking, God, another email. So I try and keep the email to once a month, and at a maximum, it'll be twice, you know. But what I do tend to do is I mix the email where some of it will be of group tours, so advise people if these are dates if anyone wants to go. But in the main, what I try and do is share links of interesting videos I've come across on YouTube about Pakistan. So most recently, I've just come across a lovely lady. She's got like an amazing house in Karachi, which is full of character and handicrafts, and you can tell she's done it beautifully. And it's an Airbnb place where, you know, you can book it. So sharing links with information like that, because I recognise that not everyone on my mailing list may be able to afford to go with me. Or, you know, there might be people who just don't like to go with companies, they like to do it themselves. So because I'm not selling you a holiday, what I'm selling you is the aspiration, desire to go to see Pakistan. Or, you know, I also actually, I'm not selling you. What I'm doing is I'm inviting you into my country to see Pakistan. So in my newsletter, I always try and share links of interesting, as I said, museums or houses or other things that may be of interest to my audience that will want to go, so that if they want to do it themselves, they've got all that information as well.
Where do people go to get on that mailing list and to see your tours, etc.?
So they go onto my website, so that's experiencepakistan.co.uk, and that's spelled with an X, there's no E. They can subscribe on there and then they can be added onto the mailing list, and then, as I said, receive. And as I said, I promise you it's no more than twice a month. And if you get fed up, you know, there's always the option to unsubscribe.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that we didn't?
Well, just that you're on the newsletter, you know, it's really interesting, because sometimes when you're writing this, certainly me, I'm very conscious that, like, am I sending relevant information to people? Are there? And what was lovely at this destination show, because obviously a lot of them are people who go there every year, so they met me last year and they're on the mailing list, that they came to me specifically just to say, just want to say, we love your newsletters. You can tell that you're writing them and it's not some marketing agency and it's from the heart, and, you know, we're really enjoying. And I just said, oh, that's really nice. And that wasn't one, that was about 8 different people, customers that came to me, or not even customers, but just people on my mailing list. And that for me, I think, has given me reassurance to know that actually I know I'm getting the balance right between something, as I said, is a bit commercial, like letting you know, but striking a balance of actually giving added value. So that's been great. I think the only other thing, Jim, I just want to add, people sometimes ask me the question, oh, we've just compared your price with another agency and you're a bit more expensive. And that's not always the case, but sometimes with me, because it's not just a commercial project, you know, with every booking you do with us, for us, what we try and do is we ensure that we are paying the local guides and the local teams slightly higher than probably the going rate, because I kind of feel that I know that, as I said, tourism is still quite far and few, so it's not like other countries where there's volumes and there's lots of people going. I think the other thing is also we kind of make a donation. So normally every year there'll be a local project or something that I'm looking to support. So last year there was a girl who was studying tourism in Hunza. She was a very intelligent girl and she managed to get a scholarship to do like one semester in Malaysia. Now, although the scholarship covered the cost of the fees, it didn't cover the cost of the maintenance, so the flights and the accommodation and everything. And so what we did is with about 2-3 other individuals, we pooled our resources. And so some of the money that I'd made, you know, it's like kind of we donated it towards sponsoring and helping that girl. So, you know, £25 from every booking does go towards a local project. When I set the company up, you know, I was working with Pakistan Alliance for Girls Education. But what I found is that when you work with established charities, sometimes I was just feeling a bit skeptical, thinking, well, some of that money is going towards marketing or admin. So now, because I've got such good working relationship with the local community, every year we work with case by case directly with local families or local people, because that way we know that your money or that money is going directly. There's no money lost in admin or marketing or anything like that. Ramadan's coming up. So in Ramadan, since COVID, we do the Ramadan food parcels. So we provide local families, local communities with a 3-course hot meal, irrespective of faith. And part of that, again, was about changing perceptions of Islam and Muslims to show that as Muslim community, we do integrate. So that we do in the UK. Just an example, like the group in February, one evening, they're going to my cousins. So they're going to be having green tea and dessert with them in their home. And that, for me, is important, because I genuinely believe that, you know, the best way to get rid of ignorance and racism is communication and dialogue. And what we all find that the minute we all sit around a table over food, we actually have a lot more in common, you know, whether we're Christian, Jewish or Muslims. And that's what we should focus on. And that's why in every itinerary, I try and at least have one meeting like this to encourage the dialogue and to get people to see people up front, the locals.
That's definitely another place that seems like it would be so interesting and the trails would be unique. And I can just imagine the food and hospitality are amazing. That's it for the interviews this week. Next week, we're looking at the walking festival on the English Riviera, also known as the Torbay area, which promises to be another great event. And we'll be taking a look at a part of Canada that recently received funding to promote its tourism, including hiking, and that is the province of Saskatchewan. Even within Canada, there are plenty of misconceptions about what it's like there. So we'll find out about walking there and set the record straight about what it has to offer. And when I say walking there, I don't mean actually walking to get there. I mean what the province has for walkers to see and do. This weekend, I have no idea what walking I will get in, if any. It's supposed to be sunny here in Scotland. Sure it is. It's also the weekend the clocks hurtle forward by an hour in North America, or most of North America. Places like Arizona don't change their time at all, which always threw me off when I lived in the US Southwest. Hopefully, if I do get to go walking, I'll be able to bore you with it next week. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this week's WalkingPost.com podcast, that you'll subscribe to it so you don't miss one, and also that you have a great week with at least one wonderful walk in it. So, until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from WalkingPost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.